From WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke. Today on the program, old factories and warehouses in Wauwatosa are becoming new stores. We'll find out why that sort of thing might become more common in the area.
As opposed to going out and finding a 50-acre cornfield and building new and providing all that infrastructure, I think the trend is being largely driven by users demanding lower rents.
We'll update a Shorewood woman's legacy letters project.
I wrote my daughter a legacy letter before I was diagnosed. At the time, I just assumed, oh, I would die before she, and so in a million years, I never expected that she would go before me. And so I was really glad that I did write the legacy letter to her.
And we'll visit an indoor skateboard park in Milwaukee's Menominee Valley. Lake Effect comes your way next, after the news. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke. Thank you so much for tuning in today. How well do you remember 2008 when the Great Recession hit? It was a gloomy time, both for our own personal finances and for the things we saw around us. Businesses closed, new growth stalled, and a sense of certainty was shaken. So it came as a surprise to many a short time later when the news came of a huge new mixed-use development on the western edge of Wauwatosa. The first phase of the Mayfair Collection development off US 45 at Burleigh is under construction now. The project is converting old manufacturing and warehouse space to a shopping center, and some are viewing it as precedent-setting in the Milwaukee area. Tim Blum is Executive Vice President at HSA Commercial Real Estate, which is developing the project. Craig Wilson is the alderman representing that area on the Wauwatosa Common Council. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Why is this development so significant? In your eyes, what makes it different than other shopping center projects that have happened or are already happening in the city of Milwaukee and the area?
Wauwatosa obviously is a high barrier of entry community, very diverse from a socioeconomic background, also from a job generation perspective with the Research Park Medical District that's situated in Wauwatosa, along with Mayfair Mall, which is the preeminent mall not only in the city of Milwaukee, but the entire state. So that was our initial interest in acquiring or assembling this 69 acres at Highway 45 and Burleigh. We started assembling the site in 2005 with our last acquisition in 2007. In looking at this site, we paid a great deal of attention to the city's master plan and tried to fulfill the spirit of that plan with a couple of different schemes, concepts over the years. After 2008, those plans changed quite a bit. And that forced us to look creatively at adaptive reuse as a way of kicking off at least the initial phase.
But when you first started conceiving of this, did you have thoughts towards creating something from the ground up?
We did. The initial idea was to scrape the entire site and build a grand mixed-use project that was very similar to what you would see in the city's master plan. So we had put forth a couple of plans. We're getting ready to move forward, and then 2008 came along and tabled those plans, but we weren't alone, obviously. You know, one of our unique skill sets as a company is our ability to recycle existing real estate, and we've done that in a number of instances in Chicago. In looking, reevaluating the buildings that were on the site, we determined that we could recycle them for, at least in this initial phase, for retail purposes. They're obsolete as far as warehouse, traditional conventional warehouse needs, but for retail, the bones of the building were perfectly fine. So we use that as a tool in order to value engineer our rents to an acceptable level that would attract good quality merchants to the project. And that was the other, I think, salient part of the plan. We wanted to create a shopping environment that was unique. So we targeted specifically best-in-class fashion promotional type tenants such as Nordstrom Rack, Saks Off Fifth, Dick's Sporting Goods, so on and so forth. So we're very diligent in terms of maintaining the integrity of that tenant mix. And what it does is it plays off of Mayfair Mall. And those promotional tenants that were looking to enter the greater Milwaukee area typically like to locate in and around the Wauwatosa area.
Well, and so then let me throw this question at you, Craig Wilson. You represent the district that this development is going to be in on the Wauwatosa Common Council, but it is going to serve shoppers clearly from well outside the city limits of Wauwatosa. In a project of this scale, how do you weigh what's right for the city and what's wanted by the people that live outside the city?
Well, it's actually pretty easy to find common goals here. You know, I live around the corner from this site, as do a number of other elected officials and city officials. And the inside joke for a while was that when your mother-in-law comes to town, you don't let her get off on that exit. You have her come up a mile or two so nobody sees it, because it is in the middle of the city, middle of the west side of the city, just down the road from the section of Mayfair Road that's, you know, comprises Mayfair Mall and a lot of reinvention that's gone along there. And it's been really strong pattern of growth and expansion on that part south of Burleigh. And as these properties opened up, even before Tim and his partners came in and started acquiring the site, the city had an eye on it, knew that something needed to happen. It's a great location to start with to kind of reinvent that side of Wauwatosa, because there's a stretch that it's about equivalent to the land that lies between Miller Park and the Harley-Davidson Museum. So the redevelopment area that occurred along Canal Street and in the Menominee Valley.
This is like Wauwatosa's very own Menominee Valley.
It's almost identical in size. You've got some of the same barriers. You've got Highway 45 on one side and a river and some train tracks on the other. North to south, it's just about the same length. And it's all 50s, 60s era kind of warehousing industrial properties that more and more companies are deciding they don't need that kind of building, they don't need that kind of layout. It's not like an old house where somebody will move in and rework the walls a little bit and decide this is what we can use for our factory. They really need something different when they come in. And it's also unlikely that we're going to fill in that entire stretch with only kind of heavy commercial and industrial users. There's going to be other types of uses in there. So as you mentioned, the neighbors and people who've been keeping an eye on it for a long time have always thought it's great for, you know, residential and some shopping and some business use, some office park, something like that. And how to find the right mix is the question. As Tim alluded to earlier, there are economics that drive that. The city's not in a position to kind of spec build a new mixed-use development and hope that people move in. And, you know, so it was great when Tim came in, his phase one plan, which happens to be retail, and it does tie in nicely and really complements what's going on down the road on Mayfair. And we'll draw kind of that regional attention, which is terrific, because this spot is located such that, while it's in the middle of the city, it's still along Highway 45 and is kind of a gateway property. So it's great to be able to plant the seed there for future expansion.
Well, and moreover, would you see this as kind of precedent setting for the whole Milwaukee area? I mean, this is a pretty wide-ranging change in use for a very industrial and manufacturing area. And, I mean, it almost seems emblematic of what's happening across southeastern Wisconsin. Would you imagine that a development like this in a place like Wauwatosa could spur the next development in some other suburb?
I think so. I think this is the model for what's going to need to happen with a lot of the suburbs and a lot of it's similar to what the city of Milwaukee has done in some places, although they have much different resources and much different needs and approaches. You know, I mentioned the Menominee Valley, where there is a defined effort to pick up land and decide how to reinvent that the city led. Here, Wauwatosa didn't have quite the same approach. But at the same time, you know, what we're going through is reflective of what a lot of the inner ring suburbs have, where there's no farmland that we can acquire and annex and build on, and rightly so. We've got the land, and it's good land, and, you know, some good buildings even that we can reuse. So it's I think, better to focus on how to kind of grow things better around you rather than, you know, stretch out and try and find a new place.
You've been involved in developments of all stripes, really. Is this becoming more common, the repurposing of existing structures?
I think so. We've been doing it for better part of 20 years over at HSA, as opposed to going out and finding a 50-acre cornfield and building new and providing all that infrastructure. I think the trend is being largely driven by users demanding lower rents, and that might be changing a little bit currently, but generally speaking, tenants, no matter if they're retail, office, industrial, are looking for rents that are generally below new construction pricing. So adaptive reuse is something that I think is going to become more and more prevalent. It just so happens this is an ideal situation for that. This first phase will open in April. That's when we're anticipating the grand opening. And it's already leading into a subsequent phase, which will be coming into the city shortly with an organic grocer, a hotel, some more restaurants. And we think this will be the platform which will start to introduce residential and potentially some office. So this is a 5 to 10 year program, and we feel the way we're sequencing the phases We're creating what the planners call that walkable sense of community by introducing the retail first and giving potential apartment dwellers something interesting to experience rather than just starting with a residential project and experiencing warehousing.
25 years ago, cities were still looking at building new indoor shopping malls, but the rule seems to be these outdoor centers rather than these being the exception. What's driving the change in what shopping centers look and feel like?
Well, that's an interesting question. I think that whole dynamic is still evolving where, you know, the idea of tenants, retail tenants in particular, searching for value is in turn being driven by their customers searching for value. And that's why I think you're seeing all the particular manufacturer outlet type of facilities coming on stream of late. But that doesn't mean you don't see a lot of other more traditional promotional discount merchants coming on stream, the Targets, the Walmarts. The outlet centers tend to be more pedestrian-oriented. They're encouraging cross-shopping and a longer stay, and we tend to be a hybrid between a promotional center and a true manufacturer's outlet. Our target audience is a fashion audience. We're targeting the larger metropolitan area, much like an outlet center would, but you're not going to see true manufacturer outlets in this project.
Now, you were not on the Common Council when the initial master plan came about in 2005, I think it was.
That's right.
Was there any concern, though, when you got into this discussion about the idea of taking the existing buildings that were there and reverse engineering them, if you will, into a retail space? I know the city had initially thought of it as, you know, just basically replacing everything that was there with something that is new. How tricky was it to get on board with this re-engineered plan?
There's two pieces to that. The first is re-engineering the buildings and using, you know, the structure that's there, and that's fantastic. And, you know, TOSA has a good history of that, largely more on the east side of North Avenue and down in the Village, where there are 100-year-old buildings and things that have been reinvented time and time again. You know, there is a strong culture of that in Wauwatosa, and, you know, that part was quickly and warmly embraced, and we like to see some of the benefits of that. As far as kind of reworking the plan, that this was, you know, if a mixed-use development has three different types of uses, this is a little different in that we're not bringing in a mix in the same ratio at first. But I saw how, you know, there's good potential for bringing in a lot of the one and then filling in more with the other as we go on. And I think that was really where the discussion went and ultimately where the Common Council was satisfied that while it might be heavy on one use at the outset, that's what's doable at this point. That's really, frankly, it will bring some new type of attraction to the area. And then beyond that, we still have an opportunity to fill in a good portion of the site with those other uses and behavior in that regard. And I think it, from what I've seen of Tim's intended phasing and even kind of his napkin scratches about the next couple of steps, I really think that's coming to fruition now, and we had made the right move.
Tim Blum, I live in Wauwatosa. I've driven past the site any number of times in recent days, and you clearly have the previous buildings stripped down to their bones. Have there been challenges that have cropped up as you got into this? I mean, obviously, you wouldn't have gone into it this way if you didn't mainly know what to expect. Has everything gone according to plan when you're dealing with buildings that are 50 and 60 years old?
I think our experience in this space allowed us to anticipate a lot of those surprises. But even then, you know, we encountered, for example, underground fuel tanks that we didn't know existed that we have to work through to remediate. And soils aren't necessarily in the best condition, so we had to mitigate some of those situations. But largely, we haven't encountered anything that I would call catastrophic. You know, I suppose all the work we're doing on Burleigh, given we've got to work through issues with DOT and city's engineering department, those can be challenging, but, you know, we're working through it. But I think thus far we're in pretty good shape.
I'll just add on to Tim's comment about Burleigh. You know, one big benefit for the city, in addition to having something terrific built at the Burleigh Triangle and immediately attracting attention to adjacent areas, we knew that Burleigh was kind of a smaller road that would not be big enough to serve what eventually needed to grow along Burleigh and even east and west of that area. We were really fortunate they were able to work with HSA and with Tim to put a plan together that allows him to do the work that we would have had to do anyway. and we don't have to pay for that effort directly out of our budget today. We don't have to put off other infrastructure work that we would do. And at the same time, very soon, as I understand it, the work on Burleigh will be done, and we'll have a shiny new road that will attract, again, people not just to this project and the ones across the street, but will also serve as a new entry point into the Mayfair corridor.
And meanwhile, everything is in course for, as you say, an April grand opening for this first phase?
That's the plan.
Well, best of luck to you, Tim Blum, Craig Wilson. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Craig Wilson is a Wauwatosa alderman. Tim Blum is executive vice president of HSA Commercial Real Estate, which is building the Mayfair Collection development on Wauwatosa's western edge. They'll both talk about that project at the Real Estate Strategies Conference this afternoon at Marquette University. Later in the program, another former manufacturing space is repurposed as an indoor skateboard park. But first, an update on a project called Legacy Letters, which we first introduced to you some time ago. This is Lake Effect on WUWM. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Tyke. A few years ago on this show, we spoke with Shorewood writer Leah Dobkin about a new business she was launching called Legacy Letters. She would help people write the stories of their lives and channel their collected wisdom and values into one heartful and comprehensive letter to be passed down to future generations. Dobkin knew that most people needed direction and guidance as they took stock of their lives, as they considered their legacies and even their mortality. Little did Dobkin know when she started the project that she'd soon have to confront the same questions her clients were facing. Dobkin tells Lake Effect Stephanie Lecce about the turn her project took.
Well, it's been a bizarre ride, for sure. When I met you and talked about Legacy Letters, a few weeks later I was diagnosed with cancer and put everything on hold, and everything we talked about and all the workshops and I put on hold until I went through chemo and gained my strength and energy back. And the very first workshop I did about helping people write legacy letters was actually at Freightert. They sponsored a workshop for fellow cancer patients and survivors. And I've been doing that on and off the last 2 years or so. Actually, another one is coming up in September. Once I gained my strength back, my last chemo was September 15th, 2011. And I started back again, trying to get this effort off the ground and to help people write legacy letters. And so that was going very well, and it's just been an amazing journey.
Then you were hit with another tragedy.
Yes. A little bit over 5 months later from my last chemo, my daughter died, my 19-year-old daughter, Hannah Rose. And so I've been dealing with that. I've been knocked down around a bit, but I'm still standing on my feet. And it gives me more motivation and a sense of urgency to help people write their legacy letters now because of this. I wrote my daughter a legacy letter before I was diagnosed. At the time, I just assumed, oh, I would die before she. And so in a million years, I never expected that she would go before me. And so I was really glad that I did write the legacy letter to her. But now I have this new sense of urgency about that everybody should do it yesterday, you know, kind of thing. The other thing is that I've been struggling with trying to figure out ways of honoring her life and making sure that her life wasn't in vain. And so over the last 2 years or so, as the legacy letters has been evolving, I've been developing specialty letters. And as a result of my daughter's death, I decided to offer Honor Your Angel legacy letters, where parents or grandparents or siblings or other loved ones can write a letter about their loved one who is deceased, about their lives and their stories and what made them special. Because one thing that's happened to me in the last, you know, year and a half and 5 days since Hannah died is that people feel uncomfortable talking about her. And what I want to do is talk about her. I want to hear her name out loud. I want to make sure she's not forgotten. I want to make sure that not only that I keep the memories alive, but that people around me remember her. And people feel uncomfortable not only bringing up her name, but what I really want is to share stories. I want to share my stories about her. It would be such a gift for people that I love, my friends and family, to share stories about her. And there's some general reluctance about that. And so I realized other parents must be going through this too. I bet they have the strong need to want to share stories about their loved ones. And so that's why I developed Honor Your Angel Legacy Letters, to help people develop these letters about their loved ones that have deceased way too early.
How does the approach differ between the traditional legacy letters, where you're kind of thinking about your own life and the sum of its parts, whereas with these, you're thinking of someone you've loved and the life that they led? How do you guide people in terms of where to begin?
Right. Well, you use more tissues. That's for one thing. I always bring a box of tissues. For Honor Your Angel Legacy Letters, what you do is you capture people's stories about that person. How did they inspire you? What do you admire most about them? What are some stories that illustrate why they're so special? And how did they impact you? What would it be like if they never were on the earth in the first place? What's the difference did they make on you and your family and friends? And on the world. I mean, my daughter, she volunteered at Discovery World. She wanted to be an oceanographer. And when she was little, she used to train goldfish to do flips at home. And at first she wanted to be a dolphin trainer. And then eventually she wanted to be an oceanographer. And so, you know, I want to talk about stories about her related to that, you know, about her love of animals, how wherever she would go, butterflies would land on her, and she had this propensity to relate to animals. And so I want to talk about that, for example. So in my legacy letter to her, it would be about her love of animals and how that was expressed.
Is there an appropriate point in the grieving process where beginning this Honor Your Angel Legacy Letter project is appropriate to begin?
I would say that the word appropriate should never be used.
Apologies.
No, that's okay, because it's grief is not understood well. No one understands grief well. We don't do well with grief here in our culture. And every person's experience is so unique that what's appropriate for someone may not be appropriate for someone else. So, for example, one thing that's helped me the last year and a half is, I just wrote a lot of poetry and just put pen to paper. I'm a writer, and it just seemed like a natural outlet where I wrote a lot of poetry about her. Someone else may feel compelled right away to write. Other people may feel like they need to digest everything and wait a year or two until they get more of a perspective. What people often don't realize that the first year, You're kind of in shock. You're numb. You're frozen. You're walking, but you're not living. You're not part of the people who are alive. You just, even though you look alive and see, talk and walk, you don't feel alive. But then in the second year, you generally start numbing, and you start feeling things more. But the support isn't there. So very often the second year is more difficult. So I could imagine for parents and grandparents that when the wonderful support you received the first year dissipates, that perhaps maybe the second year you would have a stronger need to write a letter just to keep that person's memory alive and make sure that they have a legacy and that you articulate it. So I just think that it can really vary. The other point I wanted to point out is grieving never ends. It doesn't go through stages like Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, you know, pioneered death and dying stages. It never ends. In fact, when I was driving relatives to the airport after Hannah's memorial, there was a volunteer, and she was talking to my mother. And my mother told me that she had lost her son, you know, over 50 years ago, and there's not a morning that she doesn't wake up and think about him. And so we don't realize that grief is with us. We can't bypass it. We just have to learn to work through it.
You began this Legacy Letters project before your daughter died, as you mentioned, did any of what you learned in creating the project to begin with help you in your own grief journey?
That's really an interesting question. I have been so blessed by interviewing my clients and collecting their pearls of wisdom that I realize, as a side benefit, that they have provided extra clarity in my life and extra perspective. And through the process of helping people write their legacy letter, I help people get to a perspective which I call the eternity perspective. What is the earth like without you in it? And when you get that perspective, all the little squabbles and conflicts in your life seem so minimal. And that's why I think writing a legacy letter is so healing, because you have a different kind of perspective. And so because I helped other people get that eternity perspective, when Hannah Rose died, I think I could put it in better perspective as well. And so, yes, I never even thought of that. But, yeah, it really did help me. And the legacy letter work that I do is sacred, and it's very spiritual. And so it also provided some strength, I think, to deal with her death.
What do you think Hannah Rose would say about you continuing and persevering with this project?
Right on, Mom. That's what she probably would say. She was very proud. I had a book reading at the downtown public library about the soul of a port, that book that I had written. And, you know, I had cancer and I put all my speaking engagements on hold. This was the first time I was coming back to do it. She came to that event and I was so thrilled because she helped me sell books and she was engaged in the whole process. Usually you want to give a sense of pride to your children, but sometimes as they grow up and they're older, it's nice to have it reciprocated. And after she died, I found her journal. And the last page of her journal was critiquing my my book reading. And she said such funny things. She said, "Ma, that was a great introduction." But she also said, because I had my favorite photographs in the book, and so as I would talk about stories of people down at the port, I shared my photographs and I had captions. And she says, "Well, remember, when you have a caption, some of your captions didn't have a period at the end of the sentence." So she was that observant and that engaged, and she's just an amazing young woman.
What do you hope to be giving grieving parents, grandparents, grieving loved ones like yourself through these legacy letters?
The privilege to talk about the person and to share those stories is number one, because I think it's a vehicle to help with healing. I think it also may open up a different perspective once they reflect on their lives and their lives with that loved one who deceased. So I think it may gain some clarity, some humor to lighten the load a little bit. And I think most important, I think it would be something that would be cathartic for the person to finally be able to put words to paper and really express in a way that would feel comfortable to that person, their love for that person, to in essence to say, you know, if you're paying attention to what I'm doing, this is for you too. And I just want you to know, if I didn't tell you how much I loved you when you were alive, this gives me another opportunity.
Well, Leah Dobkin, thank you so much for telling us about Honor Your Angel Legacy Letters and for telling us a little bit about Hannah Rose.
You're welcome.
Shorewood writer Leah Dobkin is the founder of Legacy Letters. She'll be giving a 6-week series on legacy letter writing at Frederick and the Medical College of Wisconsin starting September 23rd. She's also hosting a legacy letter writing circle for 4 weeks starting in late October. Dobkin is also participating in Horizon Home Care and Hospice's Life Lights event this Friday. It's an annual community memorial event in honor of lost loved ones. You can find more information about Legacy Letters, Dobkin's upcoming events, and Life Lights at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. We will shift gears substantially after a break and travel to the Menominee Valley, home for the last 14 years to an indoor skateboard park. That's coming up after the break on Lake Effect from WUWM. More of Lake Effect now. I'm Mitch Teich. The sounds you're hearing were recorded inside an old red brick building that thousands of us pass by every day and probably have never noticed. It's an old red brick Wisconsin Electric building off I-94 near the campus of Marquette University in the Menominee Valley. We're inside the Four Seasons Skate Park, which for more than a decade has launched the careers of some nationally competitive skateboarders in addition to providing a place for casual skaters to ramp up their skills. Lake Effect's Dan Harmon and Nathan Royster spent an afternoon at the skate park recently and spoke with a couple of people behind it. We'll hear first from Neil Levin, the founder and owner, who shares the history of the facility.
We opened in 1999. I had originally been living in Canada and had helped open a skateboard park in Canada at the time. I was in a different type of business, in a manufacturing business at the time. And one of my good friends had told me that there was a big void here in Milwaukee for an indoor skateboard park. So at the time, there was nothing. And he had owned a skateboard shop here in the city and had told me there's a lot of parents and kids coming in saying they would like an indoor place to ride. So he convinced me quite a bit, and I moved back in 99, and that's when I opened the skate park. I really felt like there was a need for it. There was a lot of people riding at the time, and there was no indoor place. So that's what sparked me to open the park.
And when you walk in here, it's really impressive. I mean, it's in an old building, I think you said, owned by Wisconsin Electric, or
yeah.
Used to be a
right.
If not a power plant, a power facility.
Right.
So how did you find this space? It seems like the perfect space, and we're going to put pictures on the website so people can see it, but it seems like really a perfect place for what you wanted to do.
Yeah, the space is great, and we had made a great deal of changes. When we first came into the space, it was used for metal fabricating. So in its inception, it was Wisconsin Electric. There are neighboring buildings that were used as well for that facility. But our facility at the time was a metal fabricating facility, so there were large cranes in here. And we had to do a lot of work, actually, in the building to get it to where it is now as far as this open span. There was one large crane that ran through the whole building that we ended up jackhammering out, and we poured new concrete floor. And we had to do a lot of work to get to the space that it is now. I mean, the character of the building is amazing. It does fit exactly so well for the use that we have. It gives us very little restrictions as far as what we want to build and the way that we can run things. So it gives us a lot of diversity, and that's a good thing for us. So, yeah, the building's amazing. So,
I just want to follow up because you said that the idea came to you because a friend of yours said there's nothing in Milwaukee that is like this, so there's no indoor skate park. So that's still a huge risk. I mean, why? You just took his word and moved here from Canada and dumped a lot of money into this place?
At the time, you know, I was working in Canada. I had owned my own company, and decided to sell it and move back here. I had been involved in skateboarding my whole life. I was an amateur skateboarder, sponsored skateboarder. I traveled a great deal. I was pretty knowledgeable in what skate parks, what they were doing and how they were operating around the country because I had been to a number of them. And at the time, skateboarding was really booming again. It was really one of those things that was gaining a lot of momentum. And it was a huge risk. There's no doubt about that. But I kind of felt like having the support of the local shops and the people here, I felt like we made a more of a calculated risk. It's always a risk opening your own business, no matter what it may be. But I felt confident and comfortable that we were able to do it. So, you know, I felt like I knew the sport. I didn't know so much the business side of things till I really started doing it. But it was a gamble I'm glad I took.
We're here with Neil Levin, owner of Four Seasons. Well, you just used the word sport, and that's something I wanted to find out is, are the people that come here just here to have fun generally, or are some of the skaters here actually preparing for competitions?
Well, when we first opened, skateboarding and BMX biking was just, like I said, gaining a lot of momentum back in that time. There were pros, and pros were doing pretty well at that time as well, making good money, making a good living skateboarding and BMXing. When I first think we opened, since we were so new and it was kind of the first time that there had been an indoor skateboard park here since the turf in the early 90s, I think people just came here as fun, not knowing what the future would hold. But as time went on, and as kids were coming day in and day out, and having a place that they could ride every day all year long, kids started getting really good and really being able to progress. And as they progressed over time, we've turned out actually quite a few pros from the skate park over the 14 years that we've been in business. And some of them have done very well. They're competing in the X Games and the Dew Tour and the Maloof Money Cup. There's about five or six guys from this park alone that have competed there. There's actually guys from the skate park. One of them, Greg Lutzka, who is a pro skateboarder, has won gold at the X Games. He's done really well for himself. Also, a few bikers from the skate park have competed in the X Games and done really well. And they're all making a living doing this. At this point right now, it's not a huge percentage, but, you know, there are kids that are making a living out at this point, you know. But majority of our business comes here to have fun, obviously. I think most people that come here, they don't think of a future as far as getting paid in the sport, but they are here just to have a good time. And that's what we want them to come and have. We want to have a great experience.
The other thing besides the building, when you come in and you get a kind of a panoramic view is, and we'll put a picture on the website of this as well, is the actual ramps themselves. And I asked you just casually, I wasn't even being serious, I asked you, well, did you make these all yourself? And you said, yes, all of these ramps are made by you, which I think is pretty amazing, because obviously they have to be smooth enough so that people aren't going to get injured or snag their wheels or, you know, anything could happen on them. So tell us about the design process. Are there a few set designs that you would find in any skate park? And then is there anything that is special to this one?
So I started building ramps. I'm 42 now. I started building ramps when I was about 12 years old. So I first experimented in my parents' basement and then in their driveways. So back in the day, there was really no blueprints or plans for you to build skateboard ramps. So you and your friends would just get together and kind of look or, you know, pause a video or see a picture in a magazine and try to, you know, look at that and see how things were made. And we just was by experiment. And over time, we learned how to build a ramp. And then over time, then people were putting out ramp plans. There are certain companies that were putting out ramp plans that you kind of follow. And over the years, I was building a ton of ramps. I mean, I had it in my own indoor little park with a buddy of mine. And back in the day, it was in a barn. So we used to build tons of ramps all the time there. And over time, you know, here we kind of just collected ideas from different riders, from BMX and skateboard. When we first initially designed the park, I got a lot of input. So it wasn't just me. I had taken a lot of the people from the area and said, look, what would you like to see in the skate park? You know, what are the key obstacles that you would like to see? And we kind of narrowed that down. We kind of narrowed it down because I'm a skateboarder. I'm not a BMX rider. So for our BMX side of things, I really had to go find people that, you know, knew what they were talking about and do the research. So, you know, I build everything, but I've had a lot of help, you know. Sometimes I won't even design the obstacle. Someone will come here and say, I really thought of this. This is a really cool obstacle that I'd like to see here. And we'll take it as a collective group and say, wow, this is really cool. Let's build that. So then we build it. So it's not always myself thinking everything up, but yeah, I always have a hand in building everything. And at the end of the day, the decision ends with me. But we try to open it up to a lot of different people because, you know, for me, I'm only riding a lot of transitional stuff, like the bowl, so I like to get a lot of input. So,
all right, Neil, thank you very much for coming on Lake Effect. It's a very impressive place.
I appreciate you guys coming out and taking a tour of the place. It means a lot to us. It's always good to get the word out about what we're doing and having people come and check out our space so people kind of know that it's here. And, you know, it's a good thing. I appreciate it very much. Thank you.
Neil Levin is founder and owner of Four Seasons Skate Park in Milwaukee. The place is full of ramps and jumps, but Levin talked with Dan Harmon from the edge of the skating bowl. At the opposite end of the indoor skate park, Lake Effect's Nathan Royster found Jeff Gazdowiak, a skateboarder himself, who is operations manager at Four Seasons and also gives lessons. Gazdowiak says skateboarding isn't the only thing that goes on inside the skate park.
The one thing that we do here is we allow skateboards, BMX bikes, scooters, blades. If you can ride it, we'll give you a place to do it at.
What's different about skating in, say, a skate park than on the street?
Far less hassle from people. Usually if you're out street riding, you have to deal with merchants, pedestrians, law enforcement. Where here, you're pretty much free to do whatever you like, practice, learn new things. Most of the time, it's taking things you learn here and then taking it somewhere in the street, so it's sort of a progression.
Do you feel that there's something about the skate park that you just don't get on the street?
probably more than anything, just friends and, you know, a positive vibe and energy that, you know, kind of pushes each individually, you know, maybe a little bit different, but I think the camaraderie is huge. You know, you get to ride with your friends, you don't get hassled, you meet new friends, get exposed to people that you probably normally wouldn't get exposed to. I mean, the skate park is, you know, pretty open to any nationality, boys, girls, old, young, I mean, you name it, anyone's welcome here, which is what the coolest thing about it is.
What do you skateboard?
I skateboard because it's probably the most enjoyable time I've ever had in my life. I started skating in 1986, and the feeling I get when I step on my board and push to either go from A to B or try a trick, nothing compares to that feeling.
Does Milwaukee seem particularly anti-skate?
I think overall, maybe from like a public skate park standpoint, Milwaukee's a little bit behind the times, although I think most cities definitely look down upon skateboarders and bikers because of, you know, maybe the damage that they think incurs from what we do, or the threat of lawsuits, even though anybody that rides and does what we do, you know, we don't think of, oh, I just got hurt, I'm going to sue these people over it. It's more like, I'm hurt, I can't wait to get better and try this again. You know, I think it is a misconception that we get hurt and we want somebody to help us out with it, where, you know, anybody that's in this knows the consequences and they understand what they're getting into. But I think most cities in general frown upon skateboarding and biking and, you know, anything that involves any risk.
Skate parks seem to really catch on and are much more prevalent. Where do you see skating going in the future?
I think it comes and goes in waves. You know, looking back even to like early 70s, late 70s, early 80s, like that time period, there were tons of skate parks, especially out west. California had a ton of them. And as interest peaks and then declines, the amount of skate parks decline as well. Most of those parks from that time period are all gone. I think Kona in Florida has maybe been going about 25, 30 years, but that's maybe the oldest, like, constantly open running skate park. You know, now it's definitely on a decline. A lot of my friends that work or run parks around the country are closing their doors. I think at this point in time, you know, skateboarding, biking has become sort of vanilla in that there's not as much excitement in the overall, I guess, population. I see a lot more people like dropping off, but it goes in waves. I mean, even though like now there's maybe not as many skateboarders as there were 10 years ago, you know, there's a whole new generation of dudes that are young and that are going to push skateboarding and biking to a new level. I think it almost has to like reinvent itself again. And you know, you go through, it's ups and downs, but I think as long as like the hardcore people that are really into it do it, it'll always live on, whether it's, you know, on TV or not, or in the public eye or not. You know, the things when my friends and I go out and skate, like, we do it for us. We don't go out to film and make a video and try to make a bunch of money off it. It's just, you know, the couple hours that, I mean, all of us are dads, we have regular jobs, but it's like, we just want to get out and skate. And I think as long as there's people like that, that are, you know, in it for the right reasons and don't care about publicity or what happens outside of what they're doing, you know, it'll always live on and it'll grow and eventually crumble again.
Do you think there's any particular reason why it has come and go? Is there something in the media or maybe just a new generation?
I think a lot of people want to have the image that comes from being a skateboarder or a biker, or, you know, doing something that's different. And right now, you know, if you walk into a mall, you can find, you know, any number of skateboard shoes for anybody to buy, where when I was younger, if you wanted skate shoes, you went to a skate shop, that was it. You know, you could look at people's shoes and say, oh, that guy's got rips on the side of his shoes, he's a skateboarder, like, I'm a talk to this guy or whatever. Where nowadays, you know, everybody wears the same, everybody dresses the same, whether you do or don't. You know, it's sort of more of a fad, I think. And with that, you know, people get turned off by it and turn away from it. And I think, you know, like most things, it just goes underground and, you know, regenerates, I guess.
When it comes to the shoes, do you think that waters down the culture?
A little bit, because I think a lot of people get into it for the wrong reasons. Like, they see us busy on a Saturday afternoon in December and are like, oh, these guys are getting rich. Like, no, it's December in Wisconsin and there's nowhere to ride. This is definitely not a line of work you get into to make a lot of money. It's about love of what you do and love for, in my case, skateboarding. Some of the other guys that work here BMXing, it's you do it for the big picture, and that's to, like, pass on the right knowledge to the next generation of kids coming up of why you do this. This is not, you're not going to get on TV. That's like the one percenters are the guys that clean up all the money from it. The rest of us are, you know, struggling just to get by like anybody else. And, you know, most people, you know, they think, oh, you got the best job in the world. And it's like, I do, but the drawback is I don't make any money at it, you know? So depending on what kind of person you are, like, I'm very content with scratching by. I don't have a lot of, you know, material things that I need or that I really am after. So it works good for me. But if you expect to have a really cool car and, you know, be able to take everybody out to the club every night, like, you're sorely mistaken.
Jeff Gosdowiak is the operations manager at Four Seasons Skate Park of Milwaukee, an indoor skate park in Milwaukee's Menominee Valley. He talked with Nathan Royster. Earlier in the show, we heard from founder and owner Neil Levin. You can see a slideshow of photos and watch a video of some of the action at Four Seasons at wuwm.com/lake effect. Keep listening. There's more of Lake Effect in a moment on WUWM. Yeah, when they said it's getting late in here, so I'm sorry, young man, there's no skating here, so we kick. Push, kick, push, kick, push, kick, push, coast. And away we roll, just a rebel to the world with no place to go. And so we kick, push, kick, push, kick, push, kick, push, coast. So come and skate with me, just a rebel looking for a place to be. It's Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke. Looking ahead to next week, we're going to feature a series of in-studio music performances from a variety of styles recorded in the Lake Effect studios in recent months. That series will include Seattle native Zoe Muth, who played concerts this week in Fort Atkinson and Kenosha. Here she is in the Lake Effect Performance Studio with her band, the Lost High Rollers, and a song called I've Been Gone.
Well, I've been gone. Climbing off for far too long. Next time I leave, better believe I'm taking with me. Cause the road that I'm on, morning is wide and it is long. Darling, you're the one that I want. Those men now there around Memphis, well, I know they're gonna ask a whole lot of questions. They talk in that funny way I can't always understand. Well, the first question is always how you doing. They don't hesitate in their demands. Second one's always, far too long. Next time I leave, better believe I'm taking it with me. Cause the road that I'm on, morning is wide and it is long. Darling, you're the one. headlines, hear the sounds of the hard times. Everywhere they're just about the same. Poor people getting under, nobody take the blame. From the L.A. smog,
Zoe Muth playing in the Lake Effect Performance Studio. She and others will be featured during our series of music interviews airing on this show next week. That is Thursday's edition of Lake Effect. Tomorrow on the show, our foreign policy contributor helps us break down the latest twists and turns in world reaction to the Syrian crisis. Plus, when you are planning your next vacation or road trip, why should you consider Detroit? I'm Mitch Tyke. It's great to have you listening. Thanks so much for being with us today, and I sure hope you'll take the time to join us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio. We're NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned. It's 11 o'clock now, and fresh air is next.